Good afternoon, everybody. On behalf of the Faculty of Philosophy, let me welcome you all to the 44th series of John Locke Lectures. It's a great pleasure to introduce the John Locke Lecturer for 2017, Professor Michael Smith of Princeton University, whose lectures are entitled A Standard of Judgment. One of the world's most distinguished moral philosophers, Professor Smith received his BA and MA from Monash in his native Australia, but his association with Oxford goes back a long way, to the early 1980s when he came to Oxford, to Christchurch, to take both the BPhil and the DPhil. His first teaching position, I believe, was as a college lecturer at Wadham, and since then he's held various posts at Monash, ANU and Princeton, where he's now McCosh Professor of Philosophy and also Chair of the Faculty. He's held visiting appointments at a great number of institutions worldwide, including, when he wasn't in a permanent post there, Monash, Princeton and ANU, and also, among others, Ann Arbor, Chapel Hill, Uppsala, the Humboldt in Berlin and Cambridge. He's delivered the Bormann Lectures at Umeå in Sweden, the Wittgenstein Lectures in Bayreuth and the Hurani Lectures at SUNY Buffalo. His own work has been the subject of workshops, conferences and special journal issues, and he's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, of the Academy of Humanities, and of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. Professor Smith made his reputation with his monograph, The Moral Problem, published in 1994. The definite article in the title is bold, but well chosen, in that the book sets out an argument from which, despite its very few steps, almost every one of the major positions in metaethics, including Professor Smith's own distinctive version of moral rationalism, can be derived by taking issue with some bit of it. The book exemplifies the waffle-free style of doing philosophy, which Professor Smith has maintained in his subsequent publications, whose number is now well into three figures, and which have taken him into the philosophy of action, legal and political philosophy, but of which much also has been devoted to broadening and deepening his many-faceted exploration of the connections between meta-ethics, reasons and the theory of motivation, and ethical theory. So now, without more ado, please join me in welcoming Professor Michael Smith.
Thank you for that very generous introduction. It's great to see so many familiar faces. It's not my style to read papers, but I did. My recollection was, from having seen Locke lectures before, that people did read, so I thought I'd write the first one. They're all written, actually, but I think I'll probably speak to the remaining lectures. But I will read this one. So, I'm humbled and daunted by the prospect of giving these lectures. I was a graduate student, as Edward said, at Oxford from 1981 to 1984. So I saw Dan Dennett give his Locke lectures, which turned into Elbow Room, and I saw David Lewis give his, which turned into On the Plurality of Worlds. So the bar has been set absurdly high, and my only hope is that I don't distinguish myself by giving the worst ever Locke lectures. Now, from having been at Dennett's and Lewis's lectures, I also know how difficult it is to maintain an audience over the whole of Trinity term. 6 weeks is a big time commitment, and people are incredibly busy, especially at this time of the year. So I've tried to make these lectures as self-contained as possible. I'll briefly explain. It is an extended argument throughout the whole series of lectures, but I'll briefly explain where we're up to in the argument at the beginning of each lecture. But then I'll proceed in ways that are basically going to be completely accessible to those who dip in and out. And I want to just encourage everyone to feel free to do that at your whim. At the level of detail, I really don't think of myself as saying much that's new or original in these lectures. The aim is rather to synthesise ideas that are already out there. Now, some of these ideas are my own idiosyncratic ideas, don't get me wrong. There will be some Smithiana here. But many of these ideas are not. Think of the ideas as being like the tiles of an unbounded jigsaw puzzle that depicts something or other, but where we only have the vaguest idea of what it is that's being depicted, And imagine that we've been split up into teams, given a tile and asked to figure out how that tile fits together with all the others. One source of novelty comes at the level of detail in the way in which different teams go about putting a small sample of individual tiles together. But given that the whole point of a jigsaw puzzle is to assemble the local parts into a whole, another source of novelty comes in adjudicating between competing conceptions of how the tiles fit together locally, so that when the whole is assembled, the tiles don't buckle, there are no gaps between them, and the scene that emerges is a pleasing, harmonious unity. So insofar as there's any sort of novelty aimed for, it's novelty of that latter kind. Now, one upshot is that there's a group of philosophers whose work I'll draw upon freely in what follows, because, to stick with the metaphor of the jigsaw puzzle, to my mind, these are the people who have assembled various individual pieces correctly. Now, these philosophers include, they're roughly in order of when they've lived, and if they're still alive, they're in order of age. Aristotle, Descartes, Locke will make a big appearance, Hume, Kant, Henry Sidgwick, Karl Hempel, we're now on the second, P.F. Strawson, I should say, Karl Hempel, Donald Davidson, Arthur Danto, Bernard Williams, Tom Nagel, David Lewis, Tim Scanlon, Judy Thompson, Derek Parfit, Frank Jackson, Philip Pettit, Alexander Nehemus, Michael Bratman, Gary Watson, Susan Wolfe, Mark Johnson, Sally Haslanger, Karen Jones, Ray Langton, Jeanette Kennett, and Dean Cocking. Now, my guess is that none of these people would be entirely happy with the use I make of their ideas, but it would be remiss of me not to record the fact that I think of myself as just building on what they've already said. One thing I noticed when I put this together was, of course, they're all white, that's why. But there's a sort of little glimmer of hope, because as you sort of look down this little matrix, women make an appearance heavily towards the end, so maybe we live in hope. So what are the lectures about? Well, to answer this question, I'm afraid we have to go back to 1972, when I started university. My intention coming out of high school was to major in French and mathematics. What I loved about mathematics was the systematic nature of the subject matter and the control it gave you in answering questions that seemed so daunting before you learned how to approach them. Mathematics made you ask yourself questions you'd never thought of asking, but at least it went on to teach you how to give answers worth giving to questions like those. And what I loved about French was really the exact opposite. In French, we're invited to contemplate the human condition, the best and the worst of it, and to ask ourselves where we fit in. In other words, we learned which questions were worth asking, albeit without being given much direction in how to answer them. Now, it might sound incredibly unlikely that questions like that could come up in a high school French class, in the Antipodes, no less. But what you need to know is that our French teacher for all 6 years of high school was the legendary Denis Taaffe. His classes were organised around conversation, and he motivated us to participate in conversation by showing us what a knowledge of French allowed us to do. We could read and then discuss plays by the French existentialists. Plays he took us to see performed by the cool university students at Melbourne Uni, who were part of the nascent Le Théâtre Français. We could go out to watch French New Wave cinema on a school night and wax lyrical about the movies on the way home afterwards. And we could understand songs about love and loss by French singer-songwriters like Serge Gainsbourg and Françoise Hardy. Now, though I didn't think about them in these terms at the time, these questions were normative questions about how we are to live our lives, both in ways that only concern ourselves as individuals and in ways that concern others, given the relationships we have with them. And there are also larger metaphysical questions about how, as free agents, we could fit into a world that looks like it's all too often set up to defeat us. What was exhilarating about these questions, beyond the obvious appeal they would have to a teenage wannabe from the suburbs of Melbourne, especially when raised in the context of 1960s French culture, was that they didn't presuppose anything religious or mystical. They were the sorts of questions that seemed like they might well have answers, and systematic answers at that, if only you could figure out how to find out what those answers were. Now, you won't be surprised to hear that when I enrolled in philosophy on a whim during my first year at university, in addition to enrolling in mathematics and French, I was completely bowled over. Here we were learning how to give nuanced answers to questions that were much the same as those I'd thought about in French. Now, fast forward 45 years, and you can think of these lectures as a progress report, an account of where I've got to in figuring out what our place in nature is, what it would take for us to be free in our choices and actions, how it's possible for us to be governed by norms, what the norms are by which we're governed, and whether any of these norms have a privileged status vis-a-vis other norms. The goal is to come up with an answer to the first question, the question about our place in nature, which makes it clear what the answers to the subsequent questions are. Now, with that ambition firmly in mind, let's start with a description of our place in nature. Okay, now this is... How many of you recognise this? Hand up if you do. Ah, good. One person. So this was Klimt's depiction of philosophy to the Academy in Vienna, which is... The original's been destroyed. And they hated it. They hated it. But Klimt thought that it had all the elements. So over here, we have... Actually, I don't know how to do this. Is that how you do it? Oh, yeah. So here you have the ages of man, from birth through to death. Here you have the knower. This is the bit they really hated. This was the spirit of the world. Now, from what I've said, you might be thinking that I'm going to tell you about this bit now. We're going to talk about work out how we fit in nature. You might think I'm going to talk about this. Actually, I'm going to talk about that. I want to start by asking what ways of thinking about ourselves and our place in nature are rationally obligatory and so could reasonably be expected to be shared by anyone capable of thinking at all, provided they thought things through. We're therefore going to start with what, as it seems to me, Descartes should have concluded when he sat at his chair and tried to figure out whether there was anything that he knew. Now, there is, I think, a very important lesson to be learned by starting with Descartes. But in order to learn that lesson, we need to give up on the idea that indubitability is the standard that a claim needs to meet in order to count as known from the armchair. If, as seems plain, we know a great many claims from the armchair on the basis of inference to the best explanation, then the fact that we could be brought to doubt such claims is neither here nor there. Doubts can be unreasonable. So, let's imagine ourselves in Descartes' position. We want to figure out whether there's anything that can be known to be true. And at least initially, we're going to try not to rely on any empirical information beyond what's available to us simply by engaging in the activity itself. We'll abstract away from the fact that we're sitting in a chair, and even the fact that we're human, and so on, and we'll only allow ourselves to dwell on the question. But from the fact that we're doing that, and thereby entertaining various thoughts, together with the premise that thoughts require thinkers, we conclude that there's something that we know, namely that we, the thinker of these very thoughts, exist. Now, this is clearly a contingent fact, but we appear to know it a priori, because we know it to be true simply by understanding what the thought is that we are entertaining. Now, there's a great deal packed in here, and it's worth going through it slowly to make sure we identify the different elements. Actually, just so you don't think something's going to happen that isn't, the rest of the lecture is just slowly working through the bits. Okay? Okay, so for one thing, the process of thinking takes time. So the conclusion that we exist concerns not just a presently existing entity, but a persisting entity. As a thinker, we existed in the immediate past when we set ourselves the task, and we persisted as we continued thinking things through, and our persistence explains why we exist in the present. therefore seems that we're in a position to know not just one thing, that we think and therefore we exist, but two things, that we think and so we exist, and so too does a temporal order. Now, what the nature of this temporal order is, whether you can make sense of time's arrow, for example, the question that's preoccupied my friend and colleague Hugh Price, that's entirely up for grabs. The point is just that we're committed to thinking that a temporal order of some sort exists. Now, with those thoughts in mind, two further possibilities need to be distinguished. When we think of ourselves as thinkers, are we supposing here in the present that if we existed in the past, then we were thinking in the past? Or are we supposing that we could have existed in the past without thinking in the past? Now, these questions force us to ask whether in thinking of ourselves as thinkers, we're thinking of ourselves as thinking essentially, or whether we're rather thinking of ourselves as beings with the capacity to think, a capacity we may exercise at certain times but not others, or whether we're thinking of ourselves as beings with some other nature entirely, beings who could have existed and continue to exist even when we've lost our capacity to think. Now, the answer to at least the first of these questions, at least once again, seems to be pretty clear. If we do always think, then that's because we always exercise our capacity to think. But even if we do always exercise that capacity, we can conceive of the possibility that we did not. Dreamless sleep, maybe. We might have had the capacity to think in the past, but failed to exercise it, and ditto in the future. So it seems that we're in a position to know not just two things, but three things, that we exist, that so too does a temporal order, and that what we are within that temporal order is the ground of our capacity to think. Let's hold that off a second. Whatever that ground might turn out to be. And that capacity is going to be one that we may or may not exercise. Now, whether this phase sort that we fall under, thinker, or thing with the capacity to think, is like infant and adult, whether that phase sortal thing with the capacity to think is a phase sortal like infant and adult, or whether it's a substance sortal, the kind of thing who's coming into and going out of existence is our coming into and going out of existence, well, that's still up for grabs. Now, I'll say some more about that too in a minute. Now, just seeing that we can conceive of ourselves as existing but without thinking, can we also conceive of there being a thinking but where that thinking isn't ours? In other words, can we conceive of ourselves not being alone? Well, the answer once again seems to be that we can. But if for all we know there are other thinkers, then there must be more to the present than just the ground of our capacity to think. There must also be the means to distinguish between the ground of our capacity to think and the ground of theirs. So this means that there must be the location of our capacity to think. That's what's instantiated here, and the locations of the grounds of others' capacities to think, if such grounds exist. So it seems that we're in a position to know not just three things, but four things. That we exist, that so too does a temporal order and a spatial order, and that we ourselves are located in that spatio-temporal order as the ground of the capacity to think, and that others may be so located too. Now, as with the temporal order, the nature of that spatial order is still up for grabs. The point's just that we're committed to thinking that a spatial order of some sort exists. So really here the idea is there's some sort of topology, some framework that we exist within. Now, so far I've suggested that we're the ground of our capacity to think. But remember how this whole thought experiment began. We wanted to figure out whether there's anything that can be known, and we've concluded that we know quite a lot. We were curious. We desired to figure out whether we know anything, and we satisfied that desire by thinking and thereby acquiring knowledge. Now, this suggests that we're also the ground of the capacity to know things about the world in which we live and to satisfy our desires in that world. In other words, we are agents, where an agent is anything with the two capacities just mentioned. That is, anything with the capacity to know the world in which it lives and satisfy its desires in that world. The class of agents thus includes humans like us who are capable of rehearsing for ourselves Descartes' thought experiment and so figuring out what they are. But if there are ways of satisfying desires and gaining knowledge without having any thoughts, then the class of agents also includes less sophisticated beings that may be incapable of thought. And of course that raises the possibility that the capacity to think is not essential to us. Perhaps being with the capacity to think really is a phase sortal after all, and a better candidate for our substance sortal is agent. Now, I won't take a stand on this question just now, but we will return to it later. Now, to be clear, what actions did we perform when we... What actions did we perform when we imagined ourselves in Descartes' position? The answer is that we performed various mental actions. We desired to figure out whether we knew anything. We believed the only way to do that, or the best way to do that, was by, say, focusing our attention on the question and thinking it through. That desire and belief led us to desire to focus our attention on the question, which desire in turn led us to focus our attention. And having focused our attention on the question, our thought processes just took off. Now, there are various candidates for the mental actions that we performed here, as we did several things. One thing we did was form the desire to focus our attention. Another was focus our attention. And yet another was think various thoughts. And yet another was figure out that we know something. All I've done there is list all the things that you could say, here are things we did. Now, we'll talk more about forming desires and thinking thoughts later on, but for the moment, let's just fix on focusing our attention and figuring out that we know something. What makes focusing our attention and figuring out that we know something especially good candidates for mental actions we performed is that, in the circumstances, they both seem to be things that we did intentionally. We didn't focus our attention as the result of external forces, as we might do if someone shouted our name or there was a loud bang. We focused our attention as a way to get something that we wanted, that is, as a way of figuring out whether we know something. Moreover, focusing our attention seems to be a basic mental action, that is, a mental action that we know how to perform, but where our knowledge of how to perform it isn't explained by our knowledge of how to perform some other action. I'm going to say that again. That little formulation will prove to be, it'll recur over and over. Okay, so it's a basic action in the following sense. Our knowledge how to perform it is not explained by our knowledge of how to perform any other action. This is a basic action a la Arthur Danto. Contrast the mental action of focusing our attention with the mental action of figuring out whether we know something. The latter is something we know how to do. We know how to figure out whether we know something. But we only know how to do that because we know how to do something else, namely, focus our attention on the question and then let our thoughts rip. Now, I've labored the point about mental actions for a number of reasons. One is to bring out the point just made about how there are differences in our knowledge of how to perform mental actions. Some are basic and others are non-basic. Another is to bring out how saturated the world is, as understood from the armchairs, with causes and effects. Where at least some of these, the mental actions that we know how to perform without performing some other mental action, are under our control. Our desire to figure out whether we know anything and our belief that we could do that by focusing our attention led us to desire to focus our attention on the question, and that desire in turn led us to focus our attention, and the upshot of our focusing our attention and the thinking that ensued from the exercise of our capacity to think was knowledge that we exist. It seems that we're therefore in a position to know not just four things from the armchair, but five things. How many do you think you get to know? Has to be a prime number. Seven, that's it. We know we exist, that so too does a temporal order, that so too does a spatial order, and that we're located within that spatio-temporal order as the ground of the capacity to think, whatever that may be, and that others may be so located too, and that elements within that spatio-temporal order bear causal relations to each other, some of which are under our control, and hence that even more fundamentally, We are the ground of the capacity to gain knowledge of the world and to realise our desires in it. As with the spatial and temporal orders, the nature of the causal relation is again up for grabs. The point's just that we seem to be committed to the existence of causal relations conceived of in some way or other. Now, with this much knowledge of ourselves as agents from the armchair, note that we're primed to understand what our agency consists in when we leave the armchair. This is because we know from the armchair that if our beliefs were causally connected to elements in the spatio-temporal order in such a way as to give us knowledge of those elements, and if we had desires about how the elements in the spatio-temporal order are to be, and hence knowledge of the changes that would need to be made, if changes need to be made, in order for those elements to be that way, and if these desires and beliefs were connected causally to some other element in the spatio-temporal order that was under our direct control, our body, say, that is an element that we knew how to change where our knowledge of how to change that element isn't explained by our knowledge of how to change any other element, then we'd be in a position to intentionally make changes to that element, that is, we'd be in a position to move our bodies, and that would in turn cause the changes in the elements we desire. In other words, we would be in a position to have knowledge of the elements of the spatio-temporal order and to intentionally make changes to them. Now, when we leave the armchair, what we discover is, of course, that these conditions are all met. We have sense organs that are causally connected to and so provide us with knowledge of everyday objects in the spatio-temporal order, things like other people, food, shelter and clothing. We have a body that's causally connected to those objects and knowledge of how to move our body, where that knowledge isn't explained by our knowledge of how to do anything else. And we have desires about how the objects in the spatio-temporal order are to be. That is, we have desires for things like the company of other people, food, shelter and clothing. And these desires combine with our knowledge of how to move our body and our knowledge of the changes that the movements of our body would bring about to the objects in the world to produce those movements, which in turn bring about the changes. In other words, we know where to find the people whose company we seek and the food, shelter and clothing we need, and we act intentionally by moving our bodies so as to secure these things for ourselves. Now, the story of non-mental actions that I told should sound familiar, because it's the so-called standard story of action that we inherited from Aristotle and Hume and that was developed and refined by Donald Davidson in the 1960s and 70s. From here, I'm going to omit the qualifier non-mental because I'll only be talking about non-mental actions for the next little bit. Under Davidson's influence, we've come to think of actions as having certain constitutive features. An action is just a bodily movement that's caused in the right way by a desire for an end, that is, some non-instrumental desire, and a means-end belief, a view of non-mental action that we can represent as follows. So here what happens is the means-end belief and the desire for an end cause... it's going the other way in my text. It's just flipped on the PowerPoint. Cause the bodily movement. And that complex, that whole thing, is what an action is. Now, in this picture, the unfortunately oriented arrow represents the fact that the right kind of causal relation holds between the means-end belief and the desire for an end, on the one hand, and the bodily movement on the other. But though this Davidsonian way of thinking about action has been extremely influential, it's in fact far too simple. It needs to be modified in ways suggested by two other defenders of the standard story, Karl Hempel, Davidson's teacher, and Michael Bratman, his student. So let's begin with Bratman's modification. What happens, according to this way of understanding the standard story, if you have just one desire for an end, but two means-end beliefs, and nothing to choose between them? For example, imagine desperately wanting some food for breakfast and being confronted by a supermarket shelf with many identical packets of muesli on it. There's nothing that you will get from taking the muesli packet immediately in front of you but slightly to the left that you wouldn't get from taking the one immediately in front of you but slightly to the right, and vice versa. But there's definitely something you'll get from taking one or the other that you won't get from taking any of the other options available to you, namely the very thing you desperately want, breakfast. Taking one or the other is the most efficient way of getting what you desperately want, but there's nothing that tells in favour of choosing one rather than the other. What explains your choice? What explains your bodily movement, either left or right, in this case? Davidson's version of the standard story can't answer that question. Now, what's needed in these circumstances, as Bratton points out, is a way of forming some further mental attitude that fixes you on one of your fully determinate options and keeps you fixed on that option unless there are significant changes in the background desires for ends and means and beliefs in the context of which that further mental attitude was formed. Bratman thinks of this further mental attitude as an intention, but we might equally well, and I think more sensibly, conceive of it, as Richard Holton does in his development of Bratman's view, as a willing. That is, the upshot of an exercise of a power we possess to will one of our options in these very circumstances. It's our kind of Buren's ass solution. So the modified picture looks like this. I'm sure these will all be going in the wrong direction. Backwards causation, Price would love it. According to this story, an action is really better conceived of as having this possibly extra, that's why it's in brackets, element. And it's in brackets just because it may not be necessary if the belief and the desire already fully determine the bodily movement. But it's still basically the same picture. Now, the other modification is more substantial and it requires more argument, and I'm going to spend correspondingly more time on it. 2 years before Davidson published his version of the standard story, Hempel had published his. And Hempel, remember, was Davidson's teacher. So he had taught Davidson this stuff. Now, Hempel's version is similar to Davidson's, but it's different in a quite crucial respect. Hempel thought that an additional psychological element is required among the causes of a bodily movement for that movement to count as an action. Now, to give you a flavour of what's needed, imagine an agent, John, who has... Meta comment. This example is utterly absurd and I also don't really understand it. But you'll see, I don't understand because I don't know what biceps and triceps are, but it seemed to make sense at the time. If you understand the mechanics of the body better than me and you're thinking this is absurd, I'm with you 100%. Okay. So imagine this agent, John, who has a non-instrumental desire to get stronger and the belief that something he can just do, namely flex his biceps, would make him stronger. According to Hempel, what's needed for John to flex his biceps or his muscles isn't just the non-instrumental desire and means end belief, but also the capacity to be instrumentally rational in the circumstances and the exercise of that capacity. This is needed because if John is instrumentally irrational, now, that is, either he lacks the capacity to be instrumentally rational or he has it but fails to exercise it, just keep in mind that it's always that disjunction, then notwithstanding the fact that he has a non-instrumental desire to get stronger and a belief that he can get stronger by flexing his biceps, he will not form the instrumental desire to flex his biceps. And without that instrumental desire, no biceps flexing. Now, we can represent the standard story with both Bratman's and Hempel's... Oh, gosh. Again, that's meant to be a plus sign, not a computer. Sorry about that. This is what you get for doing the modifications at the last minute. It might be this. Anyway, we can represent the standard story with both Bratman's and Hempel's modifications as follows. So means end beliefs, and then computer sign, that is plus, and now think of that as possession and exercise of the capacity to be instrumentally rational. That's what the plus sign that's masquerading as a computer represents. Those two things are needed, first of all, to guarantee that the instrumental desire has been formed, and only then perhaps you need a willing, and then those things together will cause the bodily movement that will cause the action. The presence of the exercise, the little computer, guarantees that the agent puts his desire for an end and means end belief together so as to make it the case that he has a desire for the means. Indeed, on this picture, and this is important, instrumental desires, that is, desires for means, are best thought of as nothing over and above non-instrumental desires and means end beliefs put together by the agent's possession and exercise of the capacity to be instrumentally rational. Right? Instrumental desires are not separate existences. They're not like children of parents. Right? They're just the original desire for an end and means end belief put together. There is, I think, an important truth lurking here, but in order to see what that truth is, it'll be helpful to imagine how Davidson not only might reply, but did reply when, to his great embarrassment, he had to write a paper for a Festschrift for Hempel and decided he'd write about this aspect of Hempel's work and said, I honestly don't know how come I didn't cite Hempel's paper in my original paper because he taught me that paper when I was a student. But anyway, his view is different from mine that's wrong. That's what he went on to say. And this is the bit that he says is wrong. So in other words, go back. Remember, this was Davidson's version. Now, this is Davidson's version as modified by Bratton. I think probably Davidson would accept this modification, but this one he does not accept. Now, the issue, Davidson might say, in fact did say, is whether the agent's being instrumentally rational in the circumstances is already guaranteed by something that's in his picture. So let's go back, and here's what Davidson thinks. These things, these guarantee the fact that the agent is instrumentally rational in the circumstances. Now, why? That's because those little arrows represent causation in the right way. And Davidson thought that so long as you've got causation in the right way by the belief and desire, you've already got exercise of the capacity to be instrumentally rational guaranteed. Okay, now, I'm sure this is familiar to some of you, but to some of you it's probably new, so I will slowly go through and explain why this is what Davidson's idea is here, and then I'll tell you why he's wrong. Okay, so now, first of all, why do we tell... I'll tell you a little bit more about causation in the right way. Focus on Davidson's requirement that bodily movements be caused in the right way. Imagine an actor playing a role that calls for her to shake as if extremely nervous. We can readily suppose that despite the fact that she wants to play her role and believes she can do so by shaking, once she gets on stage, her desire and beliefs so unnerve her that she's overcome and rendered totally incapable of action. Instead of playing her role as required, she just stands there, shaking nervously. She doesn't act, but instead something happens to her. And what happens to her is exactly the bodily movement that she would have performed had she acted. Now, it was because of examples like this that Davidson concluded that it's insufficient for an agent's bodily movements to be actions, that she has relevant desires and beliefs that cause those movements, because that condition is satisfied in this case. He thought, correctly, that we need to rule out the possibility of her desires and beliefs causing her to shake in the wrong way, for example, by causing her to become nervous. Now, he himself was pessimistic about the possibility of our ruling that possibility out in anything other than a completely uninformative way. That is, by stipulating that the relevant desires and beliefs must cause the bodily movements in the right way. But many think that it's plain what's needed. Here, by the way, I'm drawing on Chris Peacock's work. The crucial feature in all cases of causation... Oh, sorry, I should just say that this is Peacock, but there are various other people who had exactly the same idea, and one of whom is David Lewis. The crucial feature in all cases of causation in the wrong way, they say, is that the match between what the agent does and the content of her desires and beliefs is completely fluky. In the case just described, for example, it's entirely fluky that the actor wanted to make just the movements that her nerves subsequently caused. In order to state a sufficient condition for an agent's bodily movements being actions, we must therefore ensure that her movements are especially sensitive to the content of her desires and beliefs, as opposed to being sensitive to the operation of her relevant factors like nerves. So, the suggestion goes, the movement of an agent's body is an action, only if, in addition to the other conditions, over a range of desires and beliefs that the agent might have had, that differ ever so slightly in their content, she would still have performed an appropriate bodily movement. Had she desired to act nervously and believe that she could do so by making her teeth chatter, she would have made her teeth chatter. Had she desired to act nervously and believe that she could do that by walking around wringing her hands, she would have walked around wringing her hands, and so on. This further condition of differential sensitivity, to use Peacock's phrase, of the bodily movement to the specific contents of her non-instrumental desires and means and beliefs is clearly violated in cases of internal wayward causal chains like the one I described earlier, because, to return to that example, even if the actor had had ever so slightly different desires and beliefs, her nerves would still have caused her to do exactly what they called, namely shake when she went on stage. Now, whether or not this further requirement of differential sensitivity of an agent's bodily movements to ever so slight variations in the contents of her desires and beliefs turns the necessary condition for a bodily movement being an action into a necessary and sufficient condition is a moot point. But for present purposes, actually, that's not important. What's important is simply that some such requirement of differential sensitivity is required, whether it turns it into a sufficient condition or not. But now consider the differential sensitivity requirement. What does it amount to? Well, it amounts to nothing more or less than the requirement that the agent has and exercises the capacity to be instrumentally rational in a very local domain. For desire and belief to cause a bodily movement in the right way, for that bodily movement to count as an action, is inter alia for the agent to have and exercise his capacity to be instrumentally rational in those very circumstances. So this is what we're imagining to be Davidson's reply to Hempel. In fact, we don't have to imagine. That was his reply to Hempel. Now, consider again the example just discussed. It isn't enough that the agent has the instrumental desire to shake. She must also be such that she would have had the instrumental desire to wring her hands if she'd believed that wringing her hands was a way of acting nervous, that she would have had the instrumental desire to make her teeth chatter if she'd believed that making her teeth chatter was a way of acting nervous, and so on. For a range of ever so slight variations in the contents of her desires, and non-instrumental desires and means and beliefs. So the requirement that non-instrumental desires and beliefs cause actions in the right way does seem to entail, just as Davidson says, that the agent has and exercises the capacity to be instrumentally rational, at least in a very local domain. So far, the main thrust of the response we're imagining Davidson giving to Hempel seems to be on the mark. Hempel seems to be wrong and Davidson seems to be wrong. But with a little bit more thought, we can see that, in fact, it misses the mark. Hempel was right and Davidson was wrong. Now, in order to see why this is true, we need to sort of go back. What was the capacity to be instrumentally rational whose exercise plays an explanatory role in the production of action, according to Hempel? The answer is, whatever capacity the agent possesses, that's the answer. Whatever capacity the agent possesses and exercises, that's the one that plays a role. Davidson's reply restricts that to the capacity in a very localised domain. But to see that those two things aren't equivalent, you just need to consider the various ways in which an agent's being ever so slightly more fully instrumentally rational might manifest itself in, say, predictions that we would make about what he would do. So let's again begin by imagining a slightly more complicated but still pretty simple example. So here's my absurd knowledge of physiology here. Suppose John has a non-instrumental desire to get stronger and he believes there are two ways in which he could bring about this. He believes that his getting stronger would result from flexing his biceps or flexing his triceps, but he does not believe that he could flex both at the same time. Can you? I don't know. Where are they even? I don't even know where they are. Okay. Can you flex them both at the same time? Great. Excellent. Complete fluke. If John were fully instrumentally rational, what would he desire to do in this case? The answer is, okay, listen, the answer is, if John were fully instrumentally rational, then he would put his non-instrumental desire to get stronger together with each of those beliefs. That's because his non-instrumental desire is already targeted, so to speak, on each of these ways the world could be. He desires the realization of the possibility that he's healthy, or that he's, stronger, and he believes that this possibility partitions into two sub-possibilities: the possibility that he flexes his biceps and the possibility that he flexes his triceps. Now, putting at least one of his means-end beliefs together with his non-instrumental desire would allow him to be instrumentally rational to a certain degree. That would amount to a very, very local exercise of his capacity to be instrumentally rational. But he'd be more instrumentally rational if he were to put his non-instrumental desire together with both of his means-end beliefs. He'd be more instrumentally rational because doing so prepares him for action in a modally robust sense. He is actually such that, had he believed himself unable to, say, flex his biceps, he would still have desired to flex his triceps, and vice versa. Now, if, as seems plausible, being fully instrumentally rational is a matter of maximal preparedness to act in this modally robust sense, then being fully instrumentally rational would seem to require him to have both an instrumental desire to flex his biceps and an instrumental desire to flex his triceps. Just by the way, I'll just point this out. The sentence I just read is going to be like a linchpin in all of the weeks that follow. So it's the modal conception of what it is to be fully rational. The idea is that to be fully rational is to be maximally prepared to confront contingency. Rationality on this picture I'm going to develop is basically escape from contingency. You're going to have a plan for every way, everything the world could bowl at you, and you'll respond to it in a rational way. Okay, moreover, sticking with this case, being fully instrumentally rational would seem to have implications for the strengths of John's instrumental desires. If, for example, he's equally confident about the two causal claims just made, equally confident that flexing his biceps will cause him to get stronger and that flexing his triceps will cause him to get stronger, then if you're fully instrumentally rational, he'd be indifferent between his two options. His instrumental desires would be equally strong, and a Bratmanian willing would be required to choose between his options. But if he's more confident of one than the other, then it seems that in order to satisfy all of the demands of instrumental rationality, his instrumental desire for the one about which he's more confident would have to be stronger. The effect of decreased confidence should be to dilute the instrumental desire for that option. This too manifests itself modally. If John's fully instrumentally rational, then he's actually such that he instrumentally desires more that about which he's more confident, but had he believed that to be impossible, he would have instrumentally desired that about which he's less confident. So even though agents might be instrumentally rational to the extent that their non-instrumental desires are suitably related to two means-end beliefs they have, they might still fail to meet instrumental rationality's further demand on the strengths of their two instrumental desires. Instrumental rationality would seem to make other more global demands on agents' instrumental desires as well. Suppose this time that John has two desires, a non-instrumental desire to get stronger and a non-instrumental desire for knowledge, and that he believes all of the following: that flexing his biceps causes him to get stronger, that reading causes knowledge, and that he can't flex his biceps and read at the same time. Finally, just to keep things simple, suppose he's equally confident about each of these and that he has no other desires or beliefs. If John were fully instrumentally rational, then the considerations adduced above would seem to apply equally to the two non-instrumental desires. Instrumental rationality requires that his two non-instrumental desires be suitably related to each of his means-end beliefs. If he were instrumentally rational, then he would have both an instrumental desire to flex his biceps and an instrumental desire to read. Moreover, it once again seems that though he might be instrumentally rational in that local sense, he might fail to meet a further demand that instrumental rationality makes on the strengths of these instrumental desires. For example, if his non-instrumental desire for health and knowledge are equally strong, then it seems that if he were instrumentally rational, he'd be indifferent between the two options. His instrumental desires to flex his biceps and read would be equally strong, and a Bratmanian willing would be required to choose between them. But if one of his non-instrumental desires is stronger than the other, then it seems that, in order to satisfy the more global demands of instrumental rationality, his instrumental desire for the one which leads to the outcome that he desires more strongly would have to be stronger. The effect of having one desire stronger than another in the face of equal confidence about the ways in which these desires can be satisfied should be to intensify the strength of the instrumental desire for the means to that which one desires more. I'm labouring the point here, but I'm really only labouring the point in order to drive home a message, which is that you can fully describe the structures that are the demands of instrumental rationality. That's only playing that role. The only way to demonstrate that you can fully describe the structures is by describing them. So I have one more case. There are cases that contain elements of both of those that we've discussed thus far. Suppose John has a stronger non-instrumental desire to get stronger and a weaker non-instrumental desire for knowledge, and that he believes that flexing his biceps causes health and reading causes knowledge, and that he can't exercise and read at the same time, but he's more confident of the connection between reading and knowledge than he is about the connection between flexing his biceps and getting stronger. What does instrumental rationality require in that case? Well, once again, it seems that if John were fully instrumentally rational, he would have instrumental desires both to exercise and to read, where the strength of these instrumental desires would depend on the strengths of his two non-instrumental desires and the levels of confidence associated with his two means and beliefs. If his confidence is greater enough, then instrumental rationality may even require him that the instrumental desire to, say, read is stronger than the desire to flex his biceps. Even though the non-instrumental desire that partially constitutes it is stronger than the non-instrumental desire that partially constitutes the other instrumental desire. Okay, so that's the end of the description. If you tuned out, tune back in. Let's now return to the reply to Hempel that we're imagining Davidson to give. The claim that there's nothing for an agent's being locally instrumentally rational in the circumstances to amount to beyond the fact that his desires and means and beliefs cause a bodily movement in the right way. Well, I hope, as you can see, that even when an agent's desires and means and beliefs do issue in action, and hence the agent is instrumentally rational to some extent, the agent has and exercises capacity for instrumental rationality in the very localised domain entailed by causation in the right way. There are at least two quite distinct ways that the agent might be counterfactually. And these two possibilities turn on the extent to which the agent is instrumentally rational. Sticking with our very simple example, suppose John has an intrinsic desire to get stronger, and he believes both that he could get stronger by flexing his biceps and by flexing his triceps, but that he's more confident of the former than the latter, and hence, because he's instrumentally rational to a certain extent and has no other desires and means and beliefs, he has a stronger instrumental desire to flex his biceps. And so he flexes his biceps. From this description of the case, we can't tell how strong John's instrumental desire to flex his biceps is. You can't read that off. We know that it's stronger than his instrumental desire to flex his triceps, but it doesn't entail that it's as strong as it should be if he were fully instrumentally rational. Because that requires that the strength of his instrumental desire to flex his biceps reflects the strength of both his non-instrumental desire to get stronger and his confidence that flexing his biceps will lead him to get stronger. So far, all we know is that it reflects his degrees of confidence. But what does that further difference consist in? Well, the answer is, it consists in facts about what, say, John would have done if he'd also had a weaker non-instrumental desire for knowledge, but had had the same level of confidence that reading a book would provide him with knowledge as that flexing his biceps would make him stronger. One answer to this counterfactual question is that since John's instrumental desire to flex his biceps would have been stronger than his instrumental desire to read a book, he would still have flexed his biceps. Another is that since his instrumental desire to flex his biceps would have been weaker than his instrumental desire to read a book, he would have read a book. And if the answer is the first, then in the actual circumstances, it follows that John's instrumentally rational to a greater extent than he is if the answer is the second. Right? In other words, you only know how instrumentally rational someone is by imagining counterfactual circumstances in which they have desires with corresponding strengths and seeing what they do in those circumstances. We're now in a position to see why it's quite wrong to think that, since being instrumentally rational in a very local domain is entailed by an agent's desires and means and beliefs causing his bodily movement in the right way, it follows that his being instrumentally rational cannot be a part of the explanation of his action. Different agents possess the capacity to be instrumentally rational to very different extents, and the extent to which they possess that capacity fixes not just what actually happens when they act, fixes not just what they do when they exercise their capacity to be instrumentally rational in a very local domain, but it also fixes what they would do in various counterfactual circumstances, circumstances in which they have very different non-instrumental desires or in which their beliefs about their options are very different. It's thus an agent's possession and exercise of his capacity to be instrumentally rational to the specific extent that he has and exercises that capacity that figures in the explanation of his actions, because that's what we would appeal to in making predictions about what the agent would do in counterfactual circumstances. To be sure, some agents may be so minimally instrumentally rational that when they act, they thereby exercise all of their capacity to be instrumentally rational. This is, if you like, the limit case of an agent. But not all agents are the limit case. Some are far more instrumentally rational than that, and when they act, they exercise their far more extensive capacity to be instrumentally rational. And it's that more extensive capacity that's involved in the explanation of their actions, as we can see from the fact that you can make predictions based on whether or not it was causally implicated. Now, what's true, of course, is that the minimum required for a bodily movement to be an action is that the agent possesses and exercises the very local capacity for instrumental rationality required for his desires and beliefs to cause his bodily movement in the right way. But it would be a fallacy to move from this to the conclusion that it's an agent's possession and exercise of the minimal capacity that figures in the explanation of actions. It would be a fallacy on a par with the following. Just because all that's strictly necessary for an agent to, say, intentionally flip a switch is that they have a very specific desire concerning the outcome of his flipping the switch, the very outcome that occurred, that really the only desires that ever figure in the explanations of actions are desires for very specific outcomes. That'd be a complete fallacy. It's an empirical question which desires figure in the explanations of actions, and similarly it's an empirical question to what extent an agent is instrumentally rational figures in the explanation of their actions. So, let's sum up. The story of non-mental action that emerges from the armchair is the standard story of action that we inherited from Aristotle and Hume, that was developed and refined by Davidson in the 60s and 70s, but that requires modifications suggested by Hempel and prior to Davidson and Bratton since. According to this story, non-mental actions have certain constitutive features, their bodily movements that stand in the right kind of causal relation to three psychological states of an agent: his non-instrumental desires for ends, his means and beliefs, and his exercise of his capacity to be instrumentally rational. And perhaps also willing. Moreover, if we substitute mental doing for bodily movement, we can see that what's true of non-mental actions is true of mental actions as well. They're just mental doings that are caused in the right way by desires for ends, means and beliefs, and exercises of the capacity to be instrumentally rational, with perhaps a willing as a further causal intermediary. It seems that we're therefore in a position to know not just five things, but six things from the armchair. That we exist, that so too does a temporal order, that so too does a spatial order, that we're located within that spatio-temporal order as the ground of the capacity to think, whatever that may be, and that others may be...
Let me just get this back here. To think, and among others may be so located
too. That elements within that spatio-temporal order bear causal relations to each other, some of which are under our control, and hence that even more fundamentally, we're the ground of the capacity to gain knowledge of the world and realise desires in it. And that this, and here's the thing we've been sort of labouring over for the last 20 minutes, this presupposes that we're also the ground of the capacity to will and to be instrumentally rational to some extent. In a phrase, we are agents in a spatio-temporal world. Okay, now, consider the kind agent. That kind is, to use Judy Thompson's excellent term, a goodness-fixing kind. A goodness-fixing kind is any kind the understanding of which allows you to order members of that kind from best to worst. The best examples of goodness-fixing kinds are functional kinds. The constitutive feature of a heart, for example, is that it's an organ whose function is to pump an adequate supply of blood around the body. Because that's the constitutive feature of a heart, it follows that we can order hearts from those that succeed in pumping an adequate supply of blood around the body, they're the best, to those that do so fairly well, these are slightly worse than the best, to those that barely do so at all, these are significantly worse than the best, to those that utterly fail to do so, these are the worst. Now note that this ordering from best to worst can be understood completely in descriptive terms, because that's just what I did. Equipped with that ordering, note that we can similarly understand, again in purely descriptive terms, a range of other normative terms, both evaluative and deontic, and hence that there's no quite general is-ought or fact-value gap. Imagine that you have aching limbs and cold extremities, so you go to the doctor. He examines you and then wonders aloud, why isn't your heart functioning properly? Or why isn't your heart doing what it's supposed to do? Or why is your heart defective? We can explain the doctor's use of properly, supposed to, and defective in terms of the ordering. The constitutive feature of the heart is that its function is to pump an adequate supply of blood around the body. That's an initial is or factual claim. And it generates an ordering, which is an initial set of evaluative claims, which in turn entails that a properly functioning heart is one that does pump an adequate supply of blood around the body. There's an initial deontic claim. That hearts are supposed to pump adequate supplies of blood around the body, another deontic claim. And that a defective heart is one that fails to do so. There's another evaluative claim. So we could go on. Okay, now consider agents, the way we've described them, especially this last bit that we laboured over. The constitutive features of agents, at least as we've understood them so far, is that they're the grounds of the capacities to realise desires for ends, to have knowledge of the world in which they live, to be instrumentally rational to some extent, and to will. If we can understand each of these ideas in purely descriptive terms, more on that in just a tick, then it follows that we can similarly order agents from best to worst in purely descriptive terms, and that these orderings will in turn entail various evaluative and ought claims. Ideal agents will be those at the top of the ranking. There's an evaluative claim for you. Those at the bottom of the ranking, the ones who are barely agents at all, are very poor agents. There's another evaluative claim. And then we can use these evaluative claims to define claims about what agents ought to do, what they have reason to do. These are deontic claims. And in this way, a standard of judgment emerges from the armchair, but it's a standard of judgment that we may well be able to understand in purely descriptive terms. This is the seventh thing that we learn from the armchair. Moreover, this standard of judgment and its corresponding evaluative and deontic claims enjoy a certain privilege over all of the other standards of judgment. So although it's the moral problem and only a standard of judgment, it turns out it's the standard of judgment. But anyway. This standard of judgment enjoys a certain privilege over all of the other standards of judgment and their corresponding evaluative and ought claims that are true of agents. The privilege lies in the fact that the evaluative and ought claims associated with it are true of any being who can engage in Descartes' thought experiment simply in virtue of the fact that they're beings of that kind. It's therefore a standard of judgment for all such beings, and they are corresponding evaluative and ought claims that are true of all such beings, whether human or non-human. It's a standard of judgment that in this sense transcends the human condition. So the big question, of course, is whether I've adequately described this standard of judgment, that is, whether I've fully given a descriptive account of it, and the task in the next lecture is to confront the proposal that no, the account I've given is not adequate because it needs irreducibly nor developed. The argument, so next, the next lecture is wholly negative. The answer is, here's what some people think, and they're wrong. The next lecture. The next lecture after that will... basically, what happens here is... I have given you an incomplete depiction of what the standard of judgment is. The account of what it is to be fully rational is incomplete. But you don't need an extra normative element. You need an extra descriptive element. That's the moral of the next lecture. The lecture after tells you what that extra descriptive element is, and it will emerge that extra descriptive element gives you morality. The next lecture will be about how the moral reasons that emerge from the previous lecture interact with non-moral reasons. The lecture afterwards, we get out of the armchair altogether and we wonder how we deal with people as they actually are, which is really grubby. The answer is we have mechanisms for dealing with those people. I'm going to tie up in the last lecture with some loose ends. Mainly what I'm going to be doing, just to anticipate for those of you who... I'm telling you what's happening here so you can figure out which ones you want to come back with. What's going to happen in this lecture, by the way, just to anticipate, is that it turns out that the way you have to think about morality, as I'm thinking about it, is that morality has a much larger conventional component than people have thought. Right? That's going to be one of the take-home messages. And I'm going to be emphasising that in this lecture. In the bonus discussion section, we really will talk about the human condition. So, in this lecture slot, in the seventh week, they're going to show the movie Force Majeure. If you haven't seen it, you should come and watch it, or you should watch it on Netflix, because it's incredible. And on the Thursday, the next day, I'm going to get a talk about Force Majeure. And basically, here's my promise. My promise is that if you follow through the lectures, you will have the best conversation about Force Majeure. You won't be doing philosophy, you'll just be talking about the movie, but you'll have the best conversation about the movie you've ever had, because you'll be able to understand its elements much better than you would have if you'd just been like me when I was a beginning French student, trying to indulge my thoughts about the human condition without any rationale for it. That's it. Thank you very much.